The Roman Empire never fell. It changed its name. The emperor became the pope. The old pantheon of Roman gods became the pantheon of saints, and they are identical. Now, I'm not trying to hurt Catholics. I'm not saying that you belong to the wrong religion. I'm not telling you to change your religion. I believe in freedom. I'll fight for you to be a Catholic or a Buddhist or a Baptist or whatever you want to be. But when you come to talk to me, I'm going to tell you the truth about all of it, whether you want to hear it or not.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. A series of letter bombs sent to Trump's former opponents in the United States this week. Does that make any sense, like, at all? Yes, we look at this week's dubious terror outrage in the United States, then some real right-wing terrorism in Brazil, as Jair Bolsonaro, who harkens back to the good old days of Brazil's fascist dictators, looks to be elected president on Sunday. First, he'll relax the gun laws, and then he aims to dismantle the Brazilian state, because he said it's inherently less corrupt than the private sector. And when he gets in, the champagne corks will be popping at Southcom. Who are they? Well, they're the Americans that control Brazil now. Just a branch of the Pentagon. Also, what is the INF Treaty on Land-Based Nuclear Forces, and why is Trump pulling out of it? More importantly, what does it mean for us here in Europe if the Trump regime decides to send the special forces in to instigate regime change in Moscow, like they did in Iraq and Libya? This Cold War INF agreement saw thousands of missiles with ranges between 300 and 3,400 miles range destroyed, and all further developments of them banned. And an international criminal court lawyer from The Hague says he believes they'd rather poison defendants to death there than allow them to be acquitted. What kind of justice is that at the International Criminal Court? He also explains who really runs it. Plus, Martin Summers takes us on a tour of the world's hotspots, some of the ones the mass media have turned a blind eye to. Our sister show, Dialects, here on BCFM at noon on Tuesday. This week, the Bristol Eugenics Clinic. Something horrible going on down at Bristol Keys Assessment Centre at Temple Keys, run by private DWP contractor Contact Associates Limited. Don't you just love it when able-bodied professionals pick on disabled people and others who aren't able to fight back? Disabled Bristolian Fran Mayer updates us on how the local branch of the Department for Work and Pensions are getting on stripping her of her benefits to which she's legally entitled. Their fiendishly simple method is to refuse to test her for disabilities, which means she gets her benefits. Also, Marco Verhey will give us some history of the Bilderberg meetings at the Bilderberg Hotel itself, recorded over in Arnhem last month, that interview. Plus, former top Canadian civil servant Elizabeth Woodworth on her definitive 9/11 conspiracy report. It's called 9/11 Unmasked. You can listen to Dialect here at BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday, or download it from dialectradio.co.uk. right now. But Martin, I think we should start with this story, which is breaking news that apparently the perpetrator has been found over in the US of these various letter bomb attacks.
Well, we'll have to wait and see whether he is the perpetrator or whether all smoke and mirrors.
It's amazing that none of these letter bombs actually went off, isn't it? It's quite lucky.
Well, it is, but it looks to me as if they were designed not to go off. I mean, people who were making letter bombs generally make them to go off, and these ones that didn't have batteries in, some of them, I've seen the photographs, didn't go through the mail because they haven't been franked. The stamps haven't been franked. So we've got to suspect here, as many on the right do suspect in the US, that this is some kind of put-up job by the deep state. But, of course, that's possible because the deep state in the US is very powerful and they do all sorts of nasty stuff. And this is relatively minor compared to the stuff they usually do.
So, I mean, you're saying that some of these bombs were possibly not actually viable?
Well, then none of them were viable because none of them have exploded, have they? And in actual fact, it looks as
surely
if...
Surely that's because the FBI have come along and made sure...
We don't know, is all I will say. The suspicion that somebody in the intelligence services have set this up, or some political force has done it in order to try and influence the midterm elections, is quite possible. But the question is who... And what's the motivation? What are they trying to do? So, for example, it could be that they're trying to show Trump's opponents as being persecuted, and therefore, and they've leaped forward and said, "Oh, Trump's to blame for this because he's encouraged this kind of thing." But of course, it could well be that people who want Trump to succeed who've done this because it makes people who say these silly things look bad. If it turns out that in actual fact it was a pro-Democrat person, for example, who'd sent these things to try and make Trump look bad. And we're in the world of psychological war games, and nothing should be taken for granted.
Well, there's been an arrest in Florida. Apparently, these were posted or came from originally from Miami, Florida.
Well, if they've got somebody and they put them on trial and put it in front of a jury, then we will decide possibly what has happened here. But we don't know for sure. We're not sure who's behind it or what the political motivation is. It's clearly a political motivation. The question is what? And, of course, I'd like to remind people of the anthrax attacks following the 9/11 incident, if I can call it that, in which six people died. That was definitely carried out from inside the US because all the anthrax came from Fort Detrick in Maryland, which is the US equivalent of Porton Down. But nobody has ever been convicted of that, even though it's absolutely clear that somebody inside the US intelligence structure must have been responsible for killing those people. I think that's pertinent to bring that up at this moment when we're all supposed to be running around with our hair on fire about this.
Well, the Wall Street Journal, which is owned by the Murdochs, is saying that it's Cesar Sayoc, 56 years old, he's in custody. Two packages were found on Friday addressed to Senator Cory Booker and to James Clapper. So he's the guy who's been arrested, and all that much known about him. Online court records show he was arrested in Miami back in 2002 for another bomb threat. He received 1 year probation for the incident, according to the records. He has two other criminal cases in the Miami courts, the records show.
Well, it may well be that the police have just gone to find him because he's already got a record of sending bombs, and it may be that he's nothing to do with it at all. I'm just saying.
Well, let's have a listen anyway to the BBC breaking news coverage on 5 Live of this incident, where they went directly to the CNN headquarters in New York when these bomb threats were first heard of. And we hear from their reporter who starts this piece from 5 Live by the name of Jennifer Smith.
The US Secret Service has said that a suspected explosive device was sent to Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. A US official told the Associated Press that a functional explosive device was found at the Clintons' home. Officials do say that they proactively detonated the device and determined that it did in fact contain explosive powder and had the components of a bomb. And they were discovered by technicians who screen the mail that gets sent to these former US officials like the Clintons and the Obamas. But this is also 2 days after a bomb was found at the home of a liberal philanthropist and financier, George Soros, in the suburbs of New York City. This was confirmed to be a pipe bomb, which was discovered in a mailbox at his house, and he has become a frequent target for criticism by right-wing groups due to his support for liberal causes.
Okay, all right, that's what we know as far as we can go at the moment. Jennifer, thank you. Jennifer Smith reporting there.
We can speak, though, to Phil Unger, who runs the Flute Centre of New York, which is right opposite the Time Warner Centre. Phil, thank you very much for speaking to us. What can you see? What's been going on?
Well, I'm looking at my window right now. By the way, the Time Warner Center is not actually downtown. It's Midtown.
Right.
And there's a few hundred people outside the building. We watched the building be evacuated and people poured out. But it seems to be more of a non-event than anything else. There's a few camera crews out interviewing some people on the sidewalk. But people seem to be going about their business as they do in New York. There's not much that shocks us here anymore. And so it seems to be a day as any other day in New York City.
Well, as thankfully nobody has been injured in this series of bomb attacks, whatever it is, we will have to wait to see who the police claim has done it and what their motivation is. Because it could be that there are people who hate Trump's critics, or it could be that this guy is a Trumpist and he's it could be that he's a Trumpist and he's attacking Trump's critics, or it could turn out that he's a liberal Democrat and he's trying to make Trump look bad by sending bombs to people, which, especially bombs that don't go off, to liberal politicians and figures, to so that Trump then has to defend his own rhetoric.
Well, look,
but I definitely think there's some game going on, for sure.
So when Jennifer Smith talks about the Secret Service telling her and Associated Press, the Secret Service, is that the CIA? Who exactly is
that? Well, exactly. So in other words, we're just being told, somebody told me this, and
told Associated Press.
And in actual fact, the Secret Service are potentially suspects in a case like this, which is why, of course, you need an independent civilian police force to look into
why
it.
Why are they suspects?
Because they are trying to influence the political debate in the US.
Do they ever give things which might be potentially bombs to people in order to set them up?
They've done this loads of times with loads of people in the US. People have been approached and said, psst, 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 do you want to blow something up? Psst, 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 do you want to blow something up? And then people eventually, often people with drug, alcohol or mental health issues, are then eventually persuaded to blow something up.
I think it was maybe Ryan Gallagher at The Intercept that put a brilliant article a few years ago saying almost every terrorist attack in the United States had actually been set up by the FBI.
I think it's 100%, Tony, since 9/11.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'll put a link up 100%. To that on our show page this week.
All supposed terrorist attacks in the US.
I'll just... thisweek.org.uk.
US Intelligence Services.
So, also, they're saying it's a functional explosive device, and that they actually did try detonating it, and it had some explosive powder in it. So, what does that tell us?
Well, it tells us what they are telling us.
Oh,
they want us to hear
bomb components in it too.
Yes, okay, but if you're going
none of that actually means that it's a bomb, does it?
No, it doesn't, and it may well be that we're being told a load of fibs anyway. Don't presume that just because it's an official source that it means it's true information. Doesn't necessarily mean that at all.
What about this Soros angle?
Well, Soros is quite unpopular on the right wing in the US because he supports liberal causes that they don't like. So therefore, it could be that a right winger has sent him a bomb. But it could also be the FBI, CIA, deep state pro-Democrats who are sending him a bomb to make him look as if he's a victim so that Trump looks bad. So in other words, you can't presume that you know what's happening when some incident like this occurs.
So what about
you've got to ask the question, cui bono, who benefits?
Right, what about the strategy of tension, because this sort of thing, it does smack to me. I'm looking at the UK Times map here. We've got 8 different apparent bomb attacks, but none of them actually went off. Now this gets everyone panicking, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, the strategy
What's
of tension.
The point?
The strategy of tension, as you know, is the name for what went on in Italy during the 1970s and 1980s, where it was definitely NATO intelligence services, and they weren't sending fake bombs; they were planting real bombs, like at Bologna railway station that killed 86 people. And the idea that the intelligence services might be orchestrating this in order to create fear and so on, and so that they can have more power. Don't forget that all of the anthrax letters, which killed 6 people in the end, were sent to liberal Democrats who might have voted against the Patriot Act, so-called, which then brought in all of this kind of repressive legislation. And because they've been sent anthrax...
We've got the midterm elections coming up.
It's clearly related to the midterm elections. Whoever's done it, it's either a lone wolf, either a conservative or liberal who's acting on their own, or it's the deep state. One or the other, or possibly both. Because, of course, if the deep state are operating, they will then dump it on somebody. This guy may be the guy they're going to dump it on. Do you follow me? It doesn't mean he's done it. It just means he's the one who's going to go to court for it.
Okay, the last... also, we've got the Khashoggi case with... I think it was Sky reporting yesterday that body parts of Khashoggi have been found. This guy who it looks like was murdered in the consulate in Istanbul, a Saudi journalist working for the US newspaper, The Washington Post. But anyway, let's have a listen now to some more... a lot of questions being asked about Saudi Arabia because of this. And this was one at Prime Minister's Questions from the leader of the SNP in the House of Commons, who is Martin...
Yes, it's a difficult one. Is it Robert Jeff? I think nope. GR is in my mind.
His name begins with an I. Ian.
I've forgotten it.
Ian Blackford, anyway. I'm not saying that the SNP are inconsequential. It's just difficult to remember their names sometimes.
Ian Blackford!
Well, I'm afraid the Prime Minister said nothing about arms sales. Condemnation won't do. It's action which is required. Mr. Speaker, the Saudi Arabia regime is responsible for multiple human rights violations. Critics face death by crucifixion. Teenagers tortured. Women imprisoned for campaigning for their human rights. The brutal bombardment of Yemen, pushing that country to the brink of famine, and now the state-sponsored murder of Jamal Khashoggi. What more evidence of criminality does the Prime Minister need before she fully commits to ending the sales of arms to the brutal regime in Saudi Arabia?
Prime Minister!
I say to the Right Honourable Gentleman, we are concerned about the humanitarian issues in the Yemen, that we are actually the third largest humanitarian donor to the Yemen, and our support has provided significant support to millions of men, women and children in the Yemen. I might remind the Right Honourable Gentleman that, yes, we do support the Saudi-led coalition military intervention in Yemen. That was recognised, that has been recognised by the United Nations Security Council, and it came at the request of the legitimate President Hadi. Now, in relation to defence exports, the procedures we follow are among the strictest in the world. They were introduced in the year 2000 by the late Robin Cook. They were updated in 2014 by the Conservative-led coalition government to reflect our obligations under the Arms Trade Treaty. And a licence will not be issued to Saudi Arabia or any other destination if to do so would be inconsistent with any provision of the consolidated EU and national arms export licensing criteria. And in July 2017, the High Court ruled that our sales to Saudi Arabia were compliant with those regulations. But of course, we keep these under review.
Well, I mean, that's just basically boilerplate, isn't it?
Hang on a minute. I mean, she's saying that it was a legitimate intervention there with the legitimate president saying, inviting the Saudis in.
No. Let's put it, inviting the Saudis in. When are the elections in Saudi Arabia? Is the Saudi regime at all legitimate? It's recognised as international law.
What she's talking about is elections in Yemen. Now, President Hadi, who was elected, invited the Saudis in.
Yeah, but he was the only candidate in that election and nobody else was allowed to stand and loads of other people weren't happy with it. What you've got in Yemen is a multi-sided internal conflict between different political forces in Yemen. There's no case whatsoever for outsiders to intervene in Yemen.
Isn't it really a proxy war being waged by the West on Yemen that the Saudis are fronting?
I think the Saudis have got their own reasons for trying to keep the Yemenis under control, because they're a much more populous state than Saudi Arabia, and if things were to rights, then the Yemenis would probably have access to all of the oil money that the Saudi royal family has stolen. But of course it's also part of a geopolitical game against Iran and ultimately against Russia and China. And so the poor Yemenis are being, unfortunately for them, are in a strategic position, and the powers that be want to tell them what to do.
Okay, let's move on to take a look at Brazil now. Big election, big country, one of the BRICS nations too, Martin, on Sunday.
Yep. I mean, as you said earlier, the opinion polls, the latest I've seen, suggest that Bolsonaro will probably win. But that is just going to be the beginning of a very roller coaster ride for Brazil and for everybody else, actually, because Brazil's such an important country.
What happened to Lula? I thought he was quite
popular.
Well,
Lula's in prison on trumped up charges of corruption on the basis that he was bribed with a holiday flat, which he never went to, which seems pretty absurd. But because he's in prison on this trumped up charge, he couldn't stand in the election. And the opinion polls put him ahead of Bolsonaro, so if he'd been allowed to stand in the election, he might well have won. But of course, the Americans and their allies, the CIA, the people we were talking about earlier, have made sure that he can't stand, so that Bolsonaro gets a free run to run the country. And of course, Bolsonaro is
surely the Brazilian people understand that the Americans have been involved in this whole judicial coup process. And
well, they may do, but the fact is,
they won't vote for him.
They're
voting for an American-appointed president.
The Bolsonaro coalition is made up of all sorts of different ragbag of elements. And of course, once he comes to power, he'll have to run the country and he'll be running it very much on behalf of the multinationals. And of course, there's going to be an economic crisis, so it's not at all clear that he's going to be able to stay there for very long, because there's going to be a political explosion.
Surely the way it works is if you have some sort of crazy far right leader, that the people like the IMF start to play ball and they try and make things easier, so it feels better with him in charge.
No, because the what they want is to get rid of all the social progress that was made during the Partido de Trabajadores era, the PT Lula-Dilma Rousseff era. Bolsonaro will basically dismantle all of that, and that, of course, made a huge difference to poor Brazilians.
What happened to Dilma Rousseff?
Well, she's still out of jail, but she's also barred from standing because they're both supposedly corrupt. In other words, the two most popular left-wing politicians in the country have been ruled out of order by the Supreme Court, working, closely with the Americans, and therefore the far right get a free run at the presidency. It's pretty disgusting if you think about it.
How important is Brazil? Because there's other countries nearby which there's also quite a lot of turmoil, like Venezuela.
Well, the whole of Latin America, what they call the pink wave of the 1990s, where left-wing governments finally came to power after decades of right-wing repression in Latin America, and did a pretty good job, it has to be said. Ordinary people had their living standards improved. There was a definite change in the atmosphere. In Brazil, for example, they had this family allowance, which went to the poorest mothers, which helped them to feed their kids. All of those things were built up. But of course, it's all dependent on that wretched thing called international capitalism. And when international capitalism decides that's the end of that, that's the end of that. And so all of those social gains are in the process of being smashed. But of course, the population aren't necessarily going to remain completely passive in the face of all of this.
Well, Southcom, what's their role? Because they're based in Florida, but they seem to have quite a large role in South America these days. They say most of it is just humanitarian.
Well, it's just, Southcom is the means by which the US military controls Latin America. And, of course, they're talking about invading Venezuela, possibly. Trump's openly talked about it. Colombia is being talked about as being, they're already pretty integrated into NATO, but becoming part of NATO. And, of course, if there was any invasion of Venezuela, it would come from Colombia and possibly also from Brazil. I understand the Brazilian army had been moved to the border with Venezuela in anticipation of Bolsonaro winning on Sunday. And we could then see a joint invasion of Venezuela by Colombia and Brazil, backed by the United States. But of course, the Venezuelan army may very well resist, in which case we're going to have another crisis to deal with in Latin America, which is actually an interstate war.
Things holding up too between the United States and Russia, particularly this week with President Trump pulling out of this INF treaty, Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty. Just to recap, it is a treaty which bans weapons, ballistic missiles with ranges of all sorts of missiles, actually, ground-based missiles, between 300 and 3,400 miles in range, and developments of these have been banned. Now, the Americans have said that the Russians have violated the treaty, so there's no point in being here anymore.
Well, the reason why the Americans say that, because that kind of range of missile is no use for the Russians to shoot at the United States, which is 10,000 miles away. So the only way that those missiles, based if they exist in Russia, can only be fired towards Europe, basically. But of course, from the Russian point of view, there's a basic geographical imbalance here, because the Americans are right in their face, and if they can fire short-range missiles at them, they'll be able to hit Russia in a matter
Martin,
of minutes.
Jens Stoltenberg has said the Russian violations of the 1987 nuclear treaty with the US meant it was no longer effective. And so he's speaking ahead of these major Trident Juncture NATO exercises in Norway and Scandinavia. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg spoke for the first time since Trump said he was withdrawing from the INF treaty. He said the US was complying with the arms control treaty. The problem was Russia. The treaty could not be effective if only one side was respecting it. The treaty was signed in 1987, he said. So we don't have an effective INF treaty due to the violation by Russia, says Stoltenberg.
Well, the Russians deny that. They say that we have, and it's you're the ones who are ripping the treaty up. But of course, let's put it this way. If you rip the treaty up, then the Russians will be perfectly within their rights to develop such missiles. They've actually developed much more powerful missiles, which can whack the United States from Russia directly in a matter of minutes. That's what they've decided to do.
What
if you're going to push them to the point where they've got to be on a hair trigger, then when they're on a hair trigger, they will go all out straight away.
Okay, Stoltenberg was speaking ahead of these largest NATO joint exercises in decades. Trident Juncture is being held in Norway with 50,000 personnel from 31 countries, including Finland and Sweden, in land and sea manoeuvres around the Baltic. About 100,000 vehicles, 150 aircraft involved, based around the defence of the Nordic state against an imagined attack. So is there likely to be any kind of attack against Norway?
No, there isn't. But of course, from the Russian point of view, this is potentially an attack on them. But they're quite level-headed about it. If there is any attack on the Russians, they've got pretty good conventional defences. And if it goes nuclear, as Putin said in Valdai last week, we will nuke you. Don't imagine for 1 minute that if you go nuclear that we're not going to go nuclear. We are. And of course, they've just had the biggest exercises ever in Russia, but they were held in the Far East with the Chinese participating so that it wouldn't cause any provocation to the West. But nevertheless, they're quite prepared to defend themselves. If we want to waste money...
That could be provocative to places like Vietnam or South
Korea. Well, I mean, is anybody allowed to... If we're going to have a situation where there are no rules and anybody can have any exercises they like and we're all just going to make random threats. The point about these treaties, which were agreed in the past, the anti-ballistic missile treaty was ripped up by George W. Bush, which meant that we're back on the situation of trying to do first strikes. Yeah? Because that's what it means. If you've got anti-ballistic missiles, you can do a first strike and then you can hope that you might escape the second strike because you've decapitated the other side. They were abolished for that reason. And then the whole treaty was ripped up and we're back to where we were. In actual fact, this is a more dangerous situation now than in the run-ups of the Cuban Missile Crisis
in
1963.
I noticed this week, very interesting article you sent me from Zero Hedge, which apparently is fake news, but don't believe what you're told by CNN and the likes of them. The Russians are saying that the Americans... attack them with drones using a coordination from an aerial command plane. So this is US Air Force controlling a load of drones which attacked a Russian airbase. Now, that's an act of war, surely.
It is, and of course...
What the Russians are saying is correct.
The fact is that the Russian Defence Ministry have issued a statement saying that this took place. It's been reported on Zero Hedge, but it's not been reported on the BBC, and of course you could just say, well, the Russian Defence Ministry are making it up. But what I think, they must have known almost immediately that this American AWACS was responsible for the attack, but they haven't said anything about it because they're trying to keep it mum and try and talk to the Americans in private, like, don't do that, that's really upsetting. But now, of course, they've decided to come out with it and say, well, in actual fact, that attack on our airbase, that was run by you. It wasn't jihadis at all.
It was you that ran it. Just focus on this for a minute. The Russians say a US Navy spy plane, this is Business Insider, led a drone swarm to attack its base in Syria. Well, I mean, the Russians, maybe the Americans would argue, shouldn't be there, and we don't really want them to be there, so we're going to attack them. And this was done apparently from a Boeing PA-8 Poseidon, which looks like a sort of, basically, it's the sort of thing that would arrive at Bristol Airport. It may be a 737 or whatever. But this apparently can control a load of drones and do an attack if it wants to. A Russian defence official said, a January drone swarm attack, that's this year, on the Russian military base was commanded from this US Navy P-8A Poseidon. A swarm of 13 drones on January the 5th and 6th targeted Hmeim Air Base and Tartus Naval Facility, but Russia repelled the attacks, it said at the time. The US's P-8 can communicate with drones, but Russia provided no evidence to back its claims. The US Navy tried to attack and kill its servicemen in a thwarted strike. The Russian Defence Minister, Deputy Defence Minister Alexander Formin, said a January drone swarm was actually an American attack on the Russian air base. Now, this base in Tartus, I mean, maybe we could look upon something like Lakenheath here in Britain as an equivalent. What would we be doing if the Russians had used drones to attack Lakenheath Air Base in Norfolk?
Well, we'd already be at war with Russia. The fact is that the Russians have been kept very quiet about this for several months, and they're bringing it out now because the situation is getting more and more tense, and it's about time they brought this one out to bash the West over the head with. Now, they may be lying about it, but I don't think they are, because it was a very sophisticated attack, supposedly by jihadis who'd managed to get the technology on the internet, but in actual fact it's actually a direct attack on the Russians by the Americans.
There were three goals: uncovering the Russian air defence system in Syria, carrying out radio electronic reconnaissance, and inflicting actual harm to servicemen in Syria. So one of the things it seems that this attack achieved is that it allows the Americans to see how you react to an attack. So in other words, which missile silos open up, which gun emplacements open up. You know, for example, it might be that one pops up from something which is hardened cover, and up it pops and it starts to try and attack the drones. Yeah. And also, they can listen electronically. How electronically are they dealing with these drones coming towards them to kill them?
Yeah, that's right. So in other words, whoever was in charge on the western side decided to take the risk of a direct attack on a Russian airbase. Now, what if the Russians had done a similar thing to Akrotiri Air Base in Cyprus, for example, where nobody in Cyprus actually wants the British to be there? Do you remember they fought a war against us in the 1950s to kick us out? But we stayed, and we've got our base there, even though nobody in Cyprus wants it to be there. What if the Russians were to just whack it with a missile? Would that be okay? Since there are no rules anymore and we're all withdrawing from treaties, we'd just have to say, oh, well,
the question I asked at the top of the hour: what does it mean for us here in Europe as the Trump regime, the Pentagon, etc., start falling out with Russia in bigger and bigger scale?
What they want to do is they want to get the European Union or Union states to pay for a massive military build-up, which will keep the shareholders of Lockheed Martin and, of course, BAE Systems and Rolls-Royce in beer money. That's what it's about. And, of course, the Russians are very well aware that's what it's about. And, of course, it ties Western Europe in, or ties Europe into the American imperial system. Logically, Europe ought to be developing constructive relationships with Russia, with whom we are neighbours. But the Americans don't want that, even though they live 10,000 miles away, and they're causing all of these problems and difficulties to make sure that we can't do that. Well, that's what it's all about.
What we're discussing here may become a criminal offence in Denmark, Martin. The Danish lawmakers are proposing 12 years in prison for any pro-Russia, inverted commas, opinion. Danish lawmakers want to control opinions expressed by the public on foreign affairs, and imagined by journalists too, with a new law, which could entail criminal liability for expressing opinions similar to those of Moscow.
Well, it's where we're going. It's if we do go to war with Russia, no doubt anybody who criticises the war will immediately be accused of being a Russian agent. And therefore, that's a pretty clear signal that that's exactly where we're going to end up. And of course, the Russians don't want a war. No rational person wants a war, but we could easily end up with one, because you get everything onto a hair trigger and then suddenly crash, crash, bang, bang, wallet, we're there. It's only because the Russians showed restraint. What they could have done when those drones were attacking their airbase is just whacked Akrotiri, for example, or sunk a US warship. That would have been perfectly justifiable under international law, and then the balloon would be up, no matter what anybody wanted.
So what about this Danish law? I mean, that sounds as if it's not really Western liberal values there. I think maybe the Russians have got a point here, you find yourself in jail.
Well, indeed. And
up to 12 years.
Well, the whole point is that they're trying to make this idea of expressing opinions which might be construed as being in favour of a foreign power as treason. And we've seen it loads of times in history, this kind of game. The warmongers want to basically disempower those who are critical of their policy. But I, do you know what I think will happen? Anybody who's attempted to be prosecuted under this will have a very strong defence in international law against punishment which might be inflicted on them.
But actually, international law isn't worth a fig nowadays, is it?
All right, well, if we're going to go to a situation where international law isn't worth a fig, then maybe the Russians are going to decide to whack Akrotiri Air Base, because there's no rules. I imagine there's several hundred RAF personnel there. Maybe the only language the British understand, the Americans understand, is we've got to kill your soldiers like you kill our soldiers. And if you think we're going to give up first, you're deluded.
20 more Palestinian civilians injured by Israel's racist army this week. That story was on Press TV. Didn't hear it here on our news. But at the same time, Human Rights Watch, an American group, has condemned the Palestinian Authority for its human rights violations and using torture, allegedly, to crush dissent in Gaza.
Well, I mean, nobody is completely spotless in this situation, but I don't think the situation where you've got trained snipers shooting teenagers and children through the head at hundreds of yards range but can in any way be justified as responsible as a legitimate use of force.
What Human Rights Watch is saying here is that actually the Palestinian Authority is an authoritarian one, and if people don't agree with what they're trying to do, then they are prepared to arrest, torture and incarcerate them.
Well, one of the things about being in a war situation, Tony, as we've just been saying, is that the niceties of political debate get crushed. Hamas actually won the last election in Palestine that was held across both territories, but nobody will recognise them because Israel won't recognise them, then nobody else is allowed to recognise them. Whereas, of course, Sisi didn't win the election in Egypt. He did win an election, but his opposition were all dead or in prison, and they weren't allowed to stand. But of course, he's allowed to do that because he's our mate. But of course, Hamas can't be recognised because Israel doesn't recognise him. So basically, there are no rules. Everybody's making up as they go along. There should be rules, but there aren't.
I know you're a big fan of China, but there's some pretty horrific reports this week out about these mass construction of detention centres over there. And let's have a listen now to BBC's John Sugworth. And it's just a little part of a report that he's done on these Chinese detention camps for Xinjiang province, the one that he visited was designed for up to 10,000 people to be interned in there. And he actually visited it and spoke to some of the people who were visiting their relatives who'd been interned in this camp.
We found evidence of massive, new, highly secure facilities and evidence that they are part of a rapidly growing system right across the region. Of course, reports that China was detaining Muslims en masse in Xinjiang first began to emerge last year. There's already been some pretty credible evidence, one estimate putting the upper figure for those detained at just over 1 million. I think our evidence adds to that picture. And of course, recently what we also have is, after months and months of outright denials, China finally starting to say something. Almost certainly in response to the rising international concern, state-run TV has been showing classrooms full of supposedly grateful adult Muslims willingly undergoing re-education, or anti-extremism training, as China calls it.
Without this, I might have followed religious extremism.
But new detailed satellite analysis seen by the BBC shows a different reality. In Xinjiang's western county of Yining last year, the school football pitch can be seen. Now, satellite photos show it covered in buildings, surrounded by watchtowers. There's a new high solid steel wall around the site and guards on the gate.
Let's ask.
On a corner just outside the camp fence, we stopped to speak to a family. Some officials try to force them to leave, but another intervenes. Let them speak, she says. I ask who they're visiting. There's a pause, and then my dad, the young boy, replies.
The dad's in there.
Pretty quickly after that, we were asked to leave. Of course, China says it has a terrorism problem in Xinjiang. There have been attacks, of course, but this is a system that seems to target very broadly. People can be swept up into these facilities, we've learned, for the mildest of dissent, the most normal of religious activity, and interestingly, for any contact with Uyghurs, any contact at all with Uyghurs overseas is enough to get you detained. We tried to approach one giant suspected camp. It's one we'd seen on the satellite images, surrounded by 16 watchtowers.
There it is. That must be it over there.
The site is still being expanded on a huge scale.
Look at this. Wow.
like a mini city rising from the desert, as we get closer, we can see row after row of new buildings, all of them four stories high.
They're still all following us, are they? How many have we got behind us? One, two, three, four still. Four
including the police car.
Four including the police car.
But then the police block our way.
So here we are then, just a few metres from the camp, and as predicted, we've been stopped. If this really is all about education, then why the effort to stop us getting close?
It's huge.
It's huge. But then they pull down the walls and they construct something much bigger.
The satellite analysts from the multinational aerospace company GMV have found dozens of similar, large, highly secure facilities.
Well, I listen to what's being said. The BBC are, you know, relatively reputable source of information. But of course, you know, what's really going on is opaque. Of course, in the past, China has run a very extensive prison camp system. No doubt they still do. Their worry, of course, is that Xinjiang province would break away from China. And they know that people from the region have been going to via Turkey into Syria. There's about 10,000 jihadi militants inside Syria at the minute who are from Xinjiang.
So why don't they make getting involved in terrorism a crime and then put these people on trial? What's happening here is people are simply being interned without any kind of trial.
Well, I take your point, Tony. They may have legitimate concerns about terrorism, but that's not the way to deal with it. Now, I think this is fair comment about what China is doing, and China's got to think very carefully about what its strategy is here. Because brute force very rarely wins in this kind of situation.
Do you think internment, as it happened in Northern Ireland, for example, is actually can be a real recruiting sergeant
indeed,
for the terrorists?
Well, indeed. But and of course, I don't know what the thinking of the Chinese leadership is, or what the lie of the land is on the ground in Xinjiang. There may be a minority of extremists and a majority of moderates, or it may be that the Chinese have alienated so many people that there really is a chance that they could set up a separatist movement. But they work very closely. Mostly, those who are opposed to Chinese rule in Xinjiang, with the MIT, which is the Turkish intelligence services, because of course they share a common language. This Turkic heritage runs across the whole of Central Asia.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Well, now we turn to the, I suppose, what should be, well, we've mentioned the whole idea of international law, didn't we? The idea of war criminals going to jail. People like Tony Blair, people like George Bush, alleged war criminals, facing trial, having to answer questions. Well, this week I spoke to an international criminal court lawyer from The Hague who said he believes that they might rather poison defendants to death rather than allow them to be acquitted. He also explains who really runs the court. His name's Christopher Black, and he's Canadian.
It's a very good question, but it means there are two sets of tribunals. There are the ad hoc UN tribunals, like the Yugoslav and Rwanda tribunals in Sierra Leone, which were under UN auspices, but really controlled by the Americans and other Western intelligence agencies. And then there's the International Criminal Court, which only has jurisdiction back to 2003. And it only has jurisdiction for those countries which are members of the Rome Treaty. The United States signed on but then withdrew. Russia and China are not members of the treaty. Syria is not. Afghanistan is not. Although Afghanistan has now given permission to the ICC to do investigations.
But 2003 was the year of the illegal Iraq invasion. Surely that's right within the jurisdiction. Why haven't we seen Bush and Blair hauled before the courts?
Well, you can ask prosecutors for the ICC that question, which we've asked, and they won't give you an answer. And it's quite clear that although the United States is not a member of the Rome Treaty and is not a member of that court, it controls, the EU and the United States control the staffing of that court, and they control key members of the staff in that court, and they really approve the judges, and the prosecutors appointed by the Americans, no matter that they're not involved in it, technically speaking. The present prosecutor, Fatima Bensouda, was a former prosecutor of the Rwanda Tribunal and spent her career covering up U.S. war crimes in Africa. So they control the mechanisms of these tribunals, so there's no way that they can be charged, even if you could assume some sort of jurisdiction.
Well, this is worrying, isn't it? I mean, I was in Holland recently and speaking to just an average guy who was running a fish shop in the Hook of Holland, and he was saying how my father, who's still alive, his father lived through the war, and he said the thing my father always says is that the people in charge in The Hague now were on the wrong side during World War Two. You've been involved, I know, in The Hague. You haven't given up, like many of us might, but you've been involved in both the Rwanda and the Yugoslavia cases. Can you just take us through those?
Well, I got involved first at the Rwanda tribunal. I was my involvement came this way, briefly. When NATO attacked Yugoslavia, I was very angry about that in Toronto. We had big protests here against that. Massive protests. So I looked around for some other lawyers. What can we do as lawyers to try and do something against NATO? And there was a group here led by Michael Mandel, a professor at a law school here, who wrote the famous book, How America Gets Away with Murder. He led our team, and we filed war crimes charges against NATO at the Yugoslav Tribunal in The Hague. Because at that time, the prosecutor was Louise Arbour, who was one time my professor of criminal law and was a colleague of these other guys. Anyway, she turned us down, froze us out, and acted really as a policewoman for NATO and charged Milosevic just at the time when the French and the Germans wanted to stop the attack and conclude some sort of peace deal. So she arranged with Madeleine Albright and Bill Clinton an indictment against Milosevic. So he became a quote-unquote war criminal and therefore could not be negotiated with, and the war continued. So that allowed the war to continue and justified the war in their propaganda. All the charges against Milosevic were absolutely false. And it turned out he proved that during the trial. I got involved in 2000. I was asked by the American Association of Jurists to go to Belgrade to do an investigation onto his arrest, whether it was a political arrest or not. And I found out that it was, in my opinion. They let me speak to the new pro-NATO, pro-fascist government they had installed there after the war. And their Minister of Justice told me to my face that the charges against Milosevic were false, but they had to arrest him because the Americans demanded it, and if they did not, they were going to be bombed again. And then he was shanghaied and taken to The Hague in an RAF plane and framed up with false charges, and he spent the rest of his life defending himself against those charges till he died in his prison cell under mysterious circumstances. At the same time, I got asked to defend a Rwandan general who was the head of the national police in Rwanda. And if you accept the standard narrative in the media about Rwanda, you compare the government there to the Nazis, he would be a Himmler, head of the Gestapo. But he was acquitted of about 60 counts of genocide. And if you ask yourself, how could a man be acquitted of 60 counts of genocide, who ran a national police force, well, then you have to ask, was any of that narrative true? Because it wasn't. In fact, it was another, same as Yugoslavia, the Americans backed a proxy force like they're doing in Syria to attack a semi-socialist government, overthrow it, blame the government for war crimes, justify the installation of their puppet regime and keep it there since. And it's still under a dictatorship of Paul Kagame, who's murdered millions in the Congo since. That's how the system works. And I was lucky enough, or maybe unlucky enough, depending how you look at it, to get involved in those cases, and it's taken up the last 15 years of my life. And what I've learned about what goes on in the international criminal justice system is enough to disgust even the most optimistic person, because the people that say they're trying to control war crimes and stop war, in fact, the ones who are committing them, they're the ones who commit the war crimes, they're the ones who find scapegoats, and they're the ones who spend their lives covering up their crimes and blaming others for them.
What do you make of the media coverage? Surely some of the things would have come out, like, for example, the mysterious death of Milosevic in custody. Well, most people look at that and think, well, surely he was poisoned in his jail cell.
Right. Well, I think he was, personally. We don't have definite concrete proof of that, but there is a report. The only report done on his death was done by the NATO tribunal itself, the ICTY. It's called the Parker Report, because there's a judge involved named Parker. And even in that report, which is very pro-NATO and tries to wash their hands of any responsibility, they indicate that there were two drugs in his body which should not have been there and can't be explained. It may have had a role in his death. One was a narcotic, and one was a drug which expedites the deterioration of other drugs in the body. They accelerate the breakdown of chemicals in the body. So, and he wrote a letter 3 days before he died to the Russian embassy saying he was being poisoned. But he died before the letter could be acted upon. So I'm convinced he was poisoned. And the reason why is because he had won the case. He demolished the false charges against him. So they had one of three choices. Let him acquit him and let him go back into politics, which would be a major blow to NATO and would totally prove to the world there was no justification for their war against Yugoslavia. And he would be a major force again. Or falsely convict him, which would raise lots of questions because there's no evidence to convict him. Or they kill him. They eliminate him. And that's what happened. They couldn't let him go and they couldn't convict him, so he died.
So could you just go through briefly what the sort of charges were against him and how they fell apart?
Well, they first arrested him in Belgrade on corruption charges, claiming he'd stashed away billions. I was told by the investigating judge on that case that it was all false. He had nothing. He had no money. At The Hague, they charged him. The indictment changed over time. It was initially for some alleged massacres in Kosovo that his forces were alleged to have been involved in. That fell apart. And then they charged him with vague conspiracy charges of conspiring to create a greater Serbia, as if that's a war crime. It may be a political, issue, but they alleged that's a war crime. In fact, it wasn't true in any event. But he demolished all these charges, and he had lots of support from very high people testifying on his behalf. And all the charges, like Jeffrey Nice, the British prosecutor, was lying pretty much every day in the court there. He said the Kosovo field speech in which he alleged Milosevic said he was pro-Serbian nationalist speech was actually a speech in favor of eclecticism and ethnic diversity. It's the exact opposite of what Jeffrey Nice said it was when you listen to it. So the whole case fell apart. There was nothing against it. They were just fake charges to justify the bombing.
Well, as you know, Tony, I used to be an aid worker in Yugoslavia during that era, and I listened with interest to Christopher Black's analysis of what happened. What I would say about the International Criminal Court is that the United States has always insisted that it won't be part of the International Criminal Court because they have no intention whatsoever of their people ever being accused of war crimes.
They're appointing the judges.
Oh, yeah. So, in other words, the International Criminal Court is basically a kangaroo court which will basically go after people the West doesn't like, and that's about it. And, of course, the others conclude that there's not much point participating in it. I think the Russians have withdrawn from it for exactly the same reason, because if the Americans don't want to be part of it because they don't want to risk their people being sent, the Americans, let's be clear, they're not prepared to recognise any supranational jurisdiction over their nationals. And in that case, there's not much point having international institutions at all.
What about the UN Security Council?
Well, the UN Security Council, has different members on it, and they've got different attitudes. Most of some of them are members of the International Criminal Court, Britain, France, and Germany, and some of them aren't.
It seems like Milosevic's big crime was to be running an independent country.
Well, the point is, he was a political operator in Yugoslavia amongst with a lot of other political operators. And if you're going to criminalise people for doing politics, then you're going to find it really difficult to resolve any political situations, aren't you?
Overall, isn't it simple that Yugoslavia was a massive travesty by NATO? Really the sort of crime that we've seen, the worst regimes in history, like the Nazis, just totally taking on a country and destroying it and breaking it up for their own purposes?
Well, let's face it, it was a very complex situation because you've got a number of different republics there with a number of different politics and so on. But, of course, outside forces, particularly the Western imperialist powers, were determined to destroy independent socialist Yugoslavia. And by God, they succeeded.
Anyway, I think one of the things we'll definitely do, I had it ready for this week, but no time for it, is a real look at the East India Company and their role in the past in creating and fermenting wars, particularly after the revelations last week of these death squads in Yemen, run by private companies and funded by the Pentagon. But anyway, time to sign off for the Murdoch News at 8 now. Coming up live on Facebook, it's Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi. Thanks to our guests in the first hour, former Bradley Stoke councillor, now UKIP National Executive Ben Walker, also former squatter Rick Carey. Thanks also to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. You'll find this show's podcast, story links, comment page and our contact details at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. Do please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down. I'll leave you with a song from the Cookie Crew from 1991.
Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.